This week on the Best of Flashpoints, award-winning investigative journalist Max Blumenthal takes on the religious right wing in his book Republican Gomorrah. UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Occupied Palestine, Dr. Richard Falk, analyzes the UN report condemning Israel for war crimes in Gaza. Also, the Knight Report investigates the U.S. bombings in Somalia, an update on the case of political prisoner and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal, and an in-depth look at the 2001 U.S. anthrax attacks and the dark secrets of the shadowy world of modern-day germ weapons research. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Dennis Bernstein. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. The new right is having a field day with America's declared liberals, led by such right-wing luminaries as Glenn Beck on Fox and Karl Rove. The post-Obama right is going after the administration and anyone vaguely related to it. Witness the recent demise of Van Jones, run out of his job as special advisor to the president on green jobs on midnight. Saturday night in the middle of Labor Day weekend. While officials at all levels of the Obama administration take cover, one reporter is taking them on head on and revealing the troubling underbelly of the right wing. Max Blumenthal, an award-winning investigative reporter, is the author of the recently released Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. We spoke to Blumenthal just before airtime. In this excerpt from the interview, he begins with some background and analysis on Glenn Beck. Beck claims responsibility for running Van Jones out of Washington.
Well, let's just start with Glenn Beck, because he's the one who... the man who is behind the 9/12 project. And Glenn Beck's an interesting figure who kind of embodies the culture of personal crisis that I talked about. During his 30s, Glenn Beck, in his 20s, he wanted to be a rock and roll DJ and, you know, thought he maybe could be the next Howard Stern. He was addicted to cocaine and maybe even crack.
You're talking about Glenn Beck addicted to cocaine?
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell the Glenn Beck story.
Please.
He admits he was addicted to cocaine, but there are rumors that he was doing crack, too, and he was an alcoholic. He was a small-time DJ at a radio show and radio station in New Haven, and he was trying to be the next Howard Stern, and he was bringing he'd bring lesbians onto his show to make out, like Howard Stern does, or strippers to show their breasts, or midgets, he'd make fun of them, and you know, these kinds of things. And his demo tapes are floating around. It's only a matter of time before someone finds one of them. And I'm looking for one for him right now. And he had this personal crisis where his wife left him, and he crashed and burned. And so he met another woman who was a Mormon. He converted to Mormonism, started and got a contract with Clear Channel. Never was really particularly political, but he figured out that right-wing radio was the way to go. And he became, started making a name for himself, attacking the Democrats after the Democrats won Congress, making fun of Nancy Pelosi. And now he's been hooked up with one of Fox's top producers who listens to the Alex Jones Show, which is this extreme conspiratorial show operating out of Austin, Texas. And Alex Jones, I couldn't identify him as a Republican. He's more of a libertarian, closer to the Rush Dooney camp. He's a 9/11 truther, and he believes that Obama is planning to erect FEMA camps, concentration camps for right-wing dissidents. But Glenn Beck is able to mainstream these theories through his producer, and he's had enormous popularity giving these theories play on Fox. And he basically, what happened with Glenn Beck, the reason we're talking about him right now, is that he had an outburst on a show that wasn't his own show, where he called Barack Obama a racist, and he was targeted by an organization, Color of Change, a civil rights group, that had Van Jones on its board. Glenn Beck and his producer figured out that the group that was targeting him with this boycott had this White House czar on its board, and he had this background in the radical left in California, which speaks a language that, you know, most Americans just might be you know, not familiar with. And so they decided to target Van Jones, and the Obama administration, in one of many moments of weakness, cut Van Jones loose. And so Glenn Beck can keep going after different figures in the Obama administration. It was a huge, huge publicity coup for Glenn Beck, and it endeared him to the right, gave him a lot of credibility. And some of the other Fox News hosts, I hear, are afraid of Glenn Beck because he's getting so popular. But this is what happened. It's the Glenn Beck story. And he's been able to tap into this wellspring of hatred and resentment to Obama. But it's pure show business for him. It's cynical. It's Machiavellian. But it's a great American show business story.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're speaking with Max Blumenthal, his book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. You know, the work that you do, Max Blumenthal, and that you're doing now is incredibly important because to unravel this movement is to help people have the information they need to do the right things for themselves, you know, health care and whatever. And yet, it does seem that despite the fact that the Democrats won the White House, that they own the both houses of Congress, they're willing to cut. I mean, Van Jones was clearly revered and a hero in this community. And the word is that there's blood in the water now. They got rid of Jones and they're coming after more.
Yeah, they attempted to go after Cass Sunstein for favoring animal rights. They're going to go after Valerie Jarrett. They're reintroducing Frank Marshall Davis as a figure who is in Obama's life, who was a communist intellectual in Hawaii, and they've managed to sever the ties between Acorn and the Obama administration with these ridiculous videos, and you know, once you if you don't stop the BS in American life, if you don't stop BS right away, it just grows and grows until it consumes you and you'll drown in it. And the Obama administration didn't stop it, just like John Kerry didn't stop the Swift boat attacks by responding immediately and strongly. Instead, they've given in, and we've seen that tendency in Obama's political style throughout his whole administration, beginning with allowing Rick Warren to speak at his inauguration, a guy who supported Prop 8. And so I've always been concerned about that. I think Obama and his aides should read my book and understand that this party, which is controlled by this radical movement, has no desire whatsoever to compromise. They don't want to talk policy. They don't want a health care compromise. They don't want to do anything productive. They want to destroy him and unravel the federal government of the United States.
Let's talk about big government and separation of church and state. Now, these are people who are worried about socialism, but I imagine they don't have a problem with Christ in the classroom.
Absolutely not.
And how do you ever have a dialogue about the nature of separation in church and state and how it's at the core of the Constitution, democracy, America, and all that stuff?
Well, I won't have a theological dialogue with these people because, I mean, that's just, we're operating on their turf. There's no point in it. I don't even think there is a chance to have a dialogue with someone who thinks that America is a Christian nation, that the founding fathers, including Thomas Jefferson, intended for America to be at least a soft theocracy, and that Christianity should be a dominant culture. I don't think I should have a dialogue with them any more than I should have a dialogue with people who think that whites are biologically superior and should remain the dominant master class, and that we should move towards an apartheid society, as white nationalists believe. There's very little difference in terms of legitimacy between Christian nationalists and white nationalist groups. And so I think when I raised the question when Rick Warren was allowed to give the invocation at Barack Obama's inauguration, if he had said any of the things that he said about homosexuals and women, I mean, he favors women's submission, about African Americans, would he have been allowed the same position? I don't think so, but I think we have to see it all through the same prism. They want not just white male domination, they want Christian white male domination. And there's no point in having a dialogue with people that extends outside of the Constitution.
Glenn Beck is the, as you say, the lightning rod now. And you talked a little bit about some pretty provocative stuff in his past. I'm sure, I know that you're a good researcher, and that's not hyperbole, but could you say a little bit more about his background and how we know he was engaged in cocaine and maybe crack and all this other stuff? What is our confirmation on all this stuff? Because it's hard to believe he could get away with saying all this stuff and nobody's going to call him.
Well, it's okay in the culture that, in the subculture of the Christian right, it's okay that he did that because now he has entered, as I talked about before, he's confessed about his personal crisis and he's entered the authoritarian fray. He's not going to do it anymore. And someone like that, the sinner who's been repaired through Christ or even Mormonism, they prefer to someone who has never sinned at all but is secular. My confirmation for that is before anyone knew about Glenn Beck, I sort of got interested in him. He was on Headline News, and I went into the Strand bookstore here in Manhattan and just read a used copy of his his memoir. It's his first book. I forget the title, but it's easy to find. It's actually on Google Books, and he openly talks about having done cocaine and being an alcoholic and how, he became authoritarian through his personal crisis. And he's talked about it on air as well. And that benefits him. Just like it benefits Sarah Palin, it benefited Sarah Palin to have had a pregnant teenage daughter. People in the evangelical subculture who have pregnant teenage daughters themselves, but who preach abstinence, could relate to her on a deeper level than they could relate to any other politician.
What do you find of great concern here? What do you see happening? Where do you see this movement going? Anywhere?
There's going to be political violence. It won't be necessarily be the kind that we've seen in the past, that we saw in the 90s. But when anti-abortion militants were attacking abortion clinics and killing abortion providers, what they were really doing was attacking the federal government and people they saw as symbols of the sinful underbelly of the secular government. And we saw that happen early on in the Obama administration with Richard Poplawski, who gunned down several Pittsburgh police officers with a high-powered assault rifle. It took an entire SWAT team to take him down because he was so armed to the teeth. He was 20 years old. He was listening to Alex Jones, and he was posting YouTube videos from the Glenn Beck Show on his page at stormfront.org, which is a neo-Nazi chat site. And he believed, as his friend said afterwards to the media, that these cops were agents of the Obama agenda. And that's why he killed them, because they were symbols of the federal government. So we can expect that kind of thing. We can expect this movement's anger and vitriol to intensify if a healthcare bill is increased. And we can expect groups like FreedomWorth to rake in record donations. Same with Christian right groups like Focus on the Family. A conservative friend of mine told me that they don't want health care to fail. They want something to pass because it'll allow them to mobilize more resentment against Obama and keep the anger going and possibly win a few seats in 2010.
This is a movement, Max Blumenthal, that professes great support for Israel and the Jews. One gets the feeling sometimes that they don't maybe like Jews. What's this look like to you?
Well, you're talking about Christian Zionism, and its most powerful or influential proponent is Pastor John Hagee, who we learned a lot about during the 2008 campaign because he endorsed John McCain. But I've covered this movement. I covered it a little bit before Hagee came onto the national scene. And you can see my coverage of it in a YouTube video called Rapture Ready.
Did you say Rapture Ready? Rapture
Ready. When I went to Hagee's conference, and when people found out I was Jewish, they immediately told me I was, going to go to hell unless I converted, and they tried to convert me on the spot. They were wearing talit, and they were wearing kippot, yarmulkes, and, Jewish holy cloth. They were blowing shofars. They were basically fetishizing Judaism. and had internalized the anti-Semitic caricature of Jews to the point where I could see that their anti-Semitism was apparent. But it was rooted in a sort of naivete about who Jews really were. But if you read Hege's book, I mean, he's talking Hege's books. He says quite openly that the Holocaust was ordained by God because it forced Jews to gather in Israel, which is part of biblical prophecy. All of the Jews need to gather in Israel, including in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, which causes them to favor transferring Palestinian populations out, basically ethnic cleansing, in order to fulfill biblical prophecy and bring on the rapture when Christ will descend from a throne over Jerusalem. And when that happens, any Jew who doesn't convert to Christianity will burn in an everlasting lake of fire, which I imagine will hurt for a while, but since it's everlasting, I'll probably kind of get used to it. But this is an anti-Semitic movement that's becoming, if not influential, then dominant within the Christian right. And they have every Israeli government except the government of Yitzhak Rabin has cultivated their support and is openly working with them. And the settlers in the West Bank, these radical and violent settlers who are routinely attacking Palestinian farmers, who are committing pogroms against Palestinians in Hebron and in the neighborhood of Silwan in East Jerusalem, were recently visited by Mike Huckabee, who's an open Christian Zionist and is going to be a presidential frontrunner in 2012. And he attacked the Obama administration for calling for a settlement freeze and for calling for a freeze on Israeli construction projects in East Jerusalem, which would, for instance, mandate the demolition of 88 Palestinian homes in order to build an archaeological theme park. I mean, so it's essentially beyond influencing the Republican Party. They're helping to create a situation that could bring about an international crisis.
Do you think people such as Glenn Beck are making room for people like Lou Dobbs now to come out more and more as he is in, with his extreme anti-immigrant language, joining FAIR, the anti-immigration organization, publicly bringing into his show? Is this Glenn Beck and others opening the door? Are we moving in that direction?
I think Lou Dobbs has always been an anti-Latino bigot. Even before Glenn Beck existed, he was citing studies from the Council of Conservative Citizens, which is America's largest white supremacist group, descended from the White Citizens Council, supposedly proving that Latino advocacy groups had a plan to bring about Aztlan and take over the American Southwest. He was citing statistics from Madeline Kosman, who is an open white supremacist in California, claiming that Mexican immigrants were bringing over thousands of cases of leprosy. You know, Lou Dobbs has always been this way. What's happening, though, is if Glenn Beck is able to fight off a boycott, then Lou Dobbs becomes that much harder to boycott, and it becomes harder to pressure CNN. Just when it seemed like Lou Dobbs was on the ropes, after entertaining the crazy theories of Orly Tates and Alan Keyes that Barack Obama was not actually born in the United States, and Lou Dobbs was denounced by John Klein, the CEO of CNN, and muzzled, just when it seemed he was on the ropes, he's come back again, even crazier than before. And so, I mean, I do think Glenn Beck's creating a little bit of space by being able to fight off Color of Change's boycott. But it doesn't mean that Lou Dobbs should not be boycotted and CNN should not be pressured.
I think one of the funniest things that you did, and I think it was recorded at that most recent protest by the 9/12 Project at the National Mall, is there was a woman there. I guess she had a huge copy of, what was that, a birth certificate that showed that Barack Obama was born somewhere else, born in Africa.
Right.
And could you explain that? And you did ask her if it was true, if it was fact.
Yeah. Well, I referred to someone just a minute ago named Orly Tates, or Orly Tights, I think. She's an immigrant from Israel and Moldova who got hooked up with a lot of the far right in Orange County and Allen Keys, this political nutcase. And she's a dentist by training who got a law degree online. And she's going around the country introducing lawsuits trying to prove that Barack Obama was not born in the United States. And she recently brought that birth certificate that the woman had reproduced on her sign at the 9/12 rally in a Santa Ana, California court to claim that Barack Obama was born in Kenya. But the judge ruled that the birth certificate was obviously forged and that she was wasting his time and wasting the resources of his court by even bringing this case. But this woman, you know, had reproduced it on a huge sign, and everyone had gathered around the sign and were at this rally. They were captivated with it, that this is Barack Obama's real birth certificate. They really believe he was born in a Kenyan slum. And I said, well, this birth certificate was ruled to be a forgery. And the woman just looked at me and didn't know what to say and just said no. Because as I said, they have to self-censor in order to reconcile their reality with the reality that's based on facts.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. A United Nations investigation into Israel's brutal attacks on Gaza last December and January has concluded that the state should face war crimes tribunals by the International Criminal Court. Led by South African former Supreme Court Judge Richard Goldstone, the UN's fact-finding mission reiterated what Palestinian victims and their families were saying during and after the attacks, that Israel deliberately and wantonly targeted civilians in Gaza, quote, as a whole, and determined that the three-week bombing campaign, which killed over 1,300 Palestinians, including more than 300 children, was, quote, in furtherance of an overall policy aimed at punishing the Gaza population for its resilience and its apparent support for Hamas, and possibly with the intent of forcing a change in such support. Not surprisingly, the Israeli government, including several ministers who orchestrated the criminal attacks, swiftly denounced the UN report. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu termed the report a, quote, prize for terrorists and urged international allies to reject its findings, while Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman repeated the Knesset's adage that the Israeli army is, quote, the most moral army in the world and that the report has, quote, no legal, factual, or ethical value. Joining us to discuss the legal, factual, and ethical value of the United Nations Goldstone Report is Professor Richard Falk. Falk is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territories. Last December, the Israeli government denied him entry into Gaza after holding him in detention. Richard Falk, it's so good to have you back with us again on Flashpoints.
Thank you, Nora, for having me back.
Well, thank you. And let's jump right into the meat of this UN report. This comes after the last 8 months of an investigation spearheaded by the UN into exactly what went on in Gaza during Israel's so-called Operation Cast Lead in December and January. During the massacre, and this was not an equal-sided war in any definition of the terms, during the massacre in Gaza, international human rights experts such as yourself reported that what Israel was doing there was no less than criminal, and that those Israeli officials responsible should be held accountable in the International Criminal Court. What's your response to the Goldstone Report, and what are the major points inside the findings that should be recognized and dealt with immediately?
I think it is a major development in the effort to impose some kind of accountability on Israel for the way in which it's managed the occupation. In the end, we don't know to what extent the UN system and the major states that are members of it will implement the recommendations of the report. But what we do know is that this is a decisive Palestinian victory in what I call the legitimacy war, which is the solidarity movement with the Palestinians that is organized now all over the world and is the sequel, I think, to the anti-apartheid campaign that was so effective in eventually undermining the racist regime in South Africa. So I think it has to be looked at first as a confirmation of the main war crimes allegations against Israel, also against Hamas, that were made in relation to the Gaza attacks that began at the end of last December, and also that it calls upon the international community to act in view of these findings, giving Israel 6 months to conduct its own serious investigation that meets international standards. And if it fails to do that, which it's almost certain to do, then it proposes that the Security Council refer the situation to the International Criminal Court for an investigation as to whether to proceed with indictments and a more formal criminal inquiry. It also recommends that if this investigation fails to, in some sense, take responsibility within Israel for the crimes that were perpetrated, that universal jurisdiction should endow a national court, such as the courts in Spain and Belgium, with the authority to take action against any leaders from Israel that should venture into those countries.
That's the voice of Richard Falk. He's the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the occupied Palestinian territories. What are some of the specific instances that the Goldstone Report talks about that directly implicate Israel here?
The most general indictment of Israel's policy is to suggest that Israel throughout the campaign in Gaza fails to take reasonable precautions to prevent unnecessary civilian death. They also point to a series of incidents in which the evidence is quite convincing that civilians were deliberately targeted, even though there was no reason to think that they were in any way armed militants. Further, there were attacks on UN facilities, a UN school where it was known that it was being used as a shelter for civilians, and as well on hospitals and mosques and other targets that are off limits according to international humanitarian law. And Judge Goldstone, in his own statements, has been very clear that it was difficult for him as a Jew and a supporter of Israel to undertake this, but that it was his faith in the importance of the rule of law and the degree to which that importance depends upon an objective implementation, even against those governments that one has some sort of emotional tie with. And so I think it is important. There are certain limitations to this Goldstone report that have not been given much attention, as far as I can tell, in the media. For instance, it never investigates whether Israel had any legitimate claim to attack Gaza in the first place. It presupposes that Israel had the right to act in self-defense, whereas my understanding of the situation would suggest that there was no situation at the border that required military action, and that the truce, the ceasefire that had been established in 2008 had reduced the rocket fire practically to zero. Hamas had proposed extending that ceasefire for up to 10 years. Israel neglected to respond even to such a proposal. And so there was a diplomatic alternative to force, which undermines the argument that this was really legitimate self-defense. And even if there was no ceasefire, it seems evident that Israel was engaged in provocative acts in the weeks before it attacked Gaza, creating a situation where they would be in a condition where they could seem to justify attacking Gaza because they themselves had been retaliated against after these provocative acts. We know that there were other motives for Israel's campaign. Partly it was to overcome the defeat of the IDF in the Lebanon War in 2006. Partly it was to show that the Olmert-Livni government was tough enough in a period just prior to the Israeli elections. Partly it was to get this blow against Gaza prior to Obama assuming leadership here. And partly it was to send a message to Iran, so that all of these motivations belie the claim that this was in any sense a defensive security operation.
And speaking of the Obama administration here, we have the UN report on top of several other international and Palestinian-led reports that have come out since the attacks on Gaza. And we have yet to see the United States say a word about this, even though it implicates the U.S. as well, since it was American-made missiles and bullets and warplanes and attack helicopters that assisted in Israel's attacks on Gaza. What can you say about the U.S.'s part in this and subsequent silence by the Israel-supporting Obama White House?
I'm afraid it's not surprising, but at the same time, it's disappointing, because to the extent that one takes law and morality as a sign of a progressive leadership in this country, one would have hoped that real pressure was brought to bear, at least to end the blockade and to condemn this kind of assault upon a defenseless population. But as you suggest, there's been complicity plus silence in the face of now several confirmations of the allegations of war crimes. So one can only assume that the U.S. posture is one of acquiescence in what Israel has done, and the likelihood, I fear, is that the U.S. in the U.N. will try to insulate Israel from any effort to implement the recommendations of the Goldstone Report.
Well, finally, Professor Richard Falk, let's talk briefly about the international civil society's response and the resistance to Israel's behavior. Major unions in the U.K. just decided to launch a major boycott and divestment campaign. We saw the recent international boycott of the Toronto International Film Festival, which was involved in a rebranding campaign of Israel. And I guess the question is, if the people lead, will these leaders follow?
That's a question that we must keep asking and keep demanding that the leaders do indeed follow. I think it's a hard struggle. One should remember that in the anti-apartheid campaign, Thatcher and Reagan were both eventually pressured by their own citizens to establish sanctions, even though their strategic outlook was one that resisted putting any real pressure on South Africa. So the legitimacy war is a really important global battleground for this kind of struggle. The Palestinians clearly cannot prevail on the ground within their territory by acting in resistance. They are essentially defenseless. And so it is a matter of changing the symbolic and political relation of forces that gives this Palestinian struggle for self-determination some possibility at some future point of creating a new context in which the U.S. and Europe change their outlook, exert real pressure on Israel to produce what in the end is a fair and just outcome for both peoples that really would be beneficial, I think, for Israel's long-term security interest and would certainly be helpful to establish peace in the region.
Pentagon sources today trickled down a few more details about Monday's U.S. attack in Somalia on a leader of the al-Shabaab militia with alleged ties to al-Qaeda. At latest word, a commando contingent of Navy SEALs, Army helicopters, and offshore warships attacked two or more vehicles near the eastern shores of Somalia outside the town of Burawe, where local residents dispute the numbers of dead and wounded, and some insist that they saw false French flags despite official denials of involvement from Paris. The primary target was a 28 to 30-year-old Kenyan national of Yemeni descent named Saleh Ali Naban, whom the FBI had wanted for questioning over a 2002 bombing of an Israeli-owned resort in Mombasa, an attempted missile attack on an Israeli airliner, and the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Naban has also allegedly been fingered by young Somali Americans from Minnesota, who claim that he trained them during their highly surveilled travels to Somalia. According to the latest from Pentagon sources, the SEAL team repelled from Army choppers and laid missile and 50-caliber fire on the target vehicles, killing six and evacuating with the dead and wounded from the convoy. That, according to Washington. But Abdul Qadir Sheikh Mohammed Nur, the governor of Lower Shabelle, said that based on intelligence reports, five militants were killed, including Naban, but some local residents are insisting today that they saw at least two corpses left behind near the destroyed vehicles after the U.S. commandos fled the scene. The Pentagon says their team left with the body of Naban, although it could not be independently confirmed whether he is in fact dead or whether he and his colleagues are conceivably under secret interrogation about al-Shabaab's links with al-Qaeda in Somalia. Shabaab spokesman Sheikh Ali Mahmoud Raj said that Naban was wounded and abducted along with three of his guards, quote, but we do not know if he is alive or dead, end quote. Moreover, Naban's mother in Mombasa, Aisha Abdullah, today demanded the return of her son's putative corpus delicti for identification and burial, saying, quote, I want to see the body of my son before it is buried, end quote. Meanwhile, a statement posted on the al-Shabaab Mujahideen movement website intimates that Naban and an undetermined number of militants were killed in a fierce firefight following the commando landing. The Shabaab movement is calling for international jihadi reinforcements and proclaiming that, and here we quote, Allah foiled the endeavor of our stupid enemy who imagined that the flame of jihad in the Muslim lands will be extinguished with the killing of the Mujahideen leaders, end quote. That boast was repeated today in Baidoa, where Sheikh Mahad Abdelkarim told a news conference that, quote, we call for all Muslim fighters in the world to come to Somalia, end quote. Violence has killed nearly 20,000 Somalians and rendered 1.5 million homeless since 2007 in the wake of a U.S.-backed Ethiopian invasion to overthrow the Islamic Courts Union that had dominated, despite the creation by the United Nations of a weak interim governing regime in Somalia. Today, despite the presence of Ugandan and Tanzanian peacekeepers from the African Union, al-Shabaab controls much of Somalia's central and southern territories. Monday's operation by JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, was ordered weekend before last in an executive order from President Barack Obama, who is today enjoying a temporary respite from his losing escalation in Afghanistan. That's where the Taliban controls 80% of that country, and even the U.S. Pentagon has acknowledged that al-Qaeda is no longer a significant player in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda has also been marginalized in Iraq, where even the anti-occupation militants in the Sunni province of Anbar and nearby regions have resisted and significantly neutralized foreign jihadis from the al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia movement. Thus, with Monday's operation, President Obama is sitting pretty with the Pentagon, having reversed the military psychological trauma of the U.S. rout in the 1993 Black Hawk Down incident, which resulted in the deaths of 18 American troops and more than 1,000 Somalis. With apologies to Sam Cooke, Obama has now won a rousing refrain to his al-Qaeda lament that if he could find him, he could pound him, but as yet he hasn't found him. This week, Obama found what is being proclaimed as a major al-Qaeda target in Somalia. In other words, the growing ties between al-Shabaab and al-Qaeda in Somalia provide new opportunities to culminate Washington's current wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The third act is now being set in Somalia and other parts of Africa, where weapons, money, and contractors will soon be flowing as the Obama administration opens a new chapter of America's endless pursuit of the global war on terror. In New York, I'm Robert Knight for Flashpoints.
Thank you, Robert Knight, for another amazing report on Somalia. That's what you hear on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're going to take it back to the East Coast, Philadelphia. Delighted to be joined by Lynn Washington. He teaches journalism, I believe, still at Temple University. He's a columnist for the Philadelphia Tribune, which I think is the oldest black newspaper in the country. And he is... been on the case of Momia Abu-Jamal and the sort of, the you could say, some of the criminal activities of the local police there. Lynn Washington, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Hi, good afternoon, Dennis. Good to talk to you.
Good to have you with us again.
And you're right. I teach at Temple and I do write for the Tribune, and it is the oldest African-American-owned newspaper in the country.
Well, I'm glad I'm not too old to at least recall that. No, it is good to have you with us. Now, Lynn, I'd actually like to start in terms of the case of Momia Abu-Jamal.
Yes.
Let's talk a little bit about government misconduct and Tom Ridge.
Well, Ridge was a very interesting player in Pennsylvania. He was elected governor in around 1994 on a real law and order type of a stance. In fact, he, a few days after assuming office, held a special session of the legislature to crack down on crime, and they were increasing mandatory minimums across the board. And a proposal came to institute a mandatory minimum for persons caught stealing money from state government. And he opposed it. Well, the reality is that those who will be most in line to do that don't look like the majority of those who are filling Pennsylvania's prisons to the tune of 44,000 people when it was only 18,000 people in 1980. So with Ridge, we see this person who talks tough but is really not serious about it. Now, where Ridge comes into to the Momia Abu-Jamal case is in 1995. Abu-Jamal had a very critical hearing. If many of your listeners know that the trial that Abu-Jamal endured in 1982 was an absolute farce. I mean, Amnesty International said that it failed to meet even the minimum standards of a fair trial. So in 95, there was an effort to essentially go over evidence that was excluded in 82 and re-examine the case. Unfortunately, it was before the same judge who presided over the trial in 1982. There was an effort for him to recuse himself. He refused. But now, where does Ridge come in? Well, the Fraternal Order of Police in Philadelphia is the police union, and they've been the major advocates for Abu-Jamal's execution. They requested that the prison authorities crack down on Abu-Jamal because he was writing books and commentaries and doing radio broadcasts, and they complied with this. And in the process of doing that, they began to illegally open Abu-Jamal's mail, including correspondence between his attorneys and him. This is the sanctity of attorney-client privilege is supposedly one of the bedrocks of the American legal system, and you just don't do that according to, you know, those who extol the values and virtues of the American justice system. Well, they did it. And not only did the prison authorities illegally open Abu-Jamal's mail, but they forwarded all of those correspondences between him and his attorney to the governor's office. So Abu-Jamal and his attorneys were strategizing on when they were going to file this appeal in 1995, how they were going to handle things in court. And what Tom Ridge did in a very low ball and dirt ball move was, on the eve of the filing of the appeal, he issued a death warrant. And that, well, number one, was illegal because Abu-Jamal had a right to appeal before any kind of death warrant could be instituted. But that implementation of the death warrant just turned the whole appeals process on its head. The biased judge that was presiding over it, Albert Sabo, used the death warrant to expedite the hearing and really pushed it really quick. So the defense was not able to put on the type of witnesses that they wanted and all sorts of things. So the bottom line was that Ridge's improper and illegal intervention in the case sabotaged Abu Jamal's appeals in 1995. So when people say that, well, Abu Jamal has had appeals and they've all been upheld and in his case there's nothing wrong with it because the courts have handled it, that is ludicrous when you look at that. And now we flash forward to, what would it be, this is 08, last year when the Third Circuit Court of Appeals rendered their ruling, they indicated in their ruling that there was no improprieties in Abu Jamal's conviction. And one of the issues during that appeal was whether Sabo was biased during that 1995 appeals hearing, and the Third Circuit panel of the Federal Third Circuit Court of Appeals that sits in Philadelphia said that they found no problems with it and no problems with Sabo, when in fact this scenario that I just laid out to you about the improper and illegal intervention of Tom Ridge, that was listed, or should I say that is listed, in a Third Circuit Court of Appeals case in 1999, when they indicated that Abu Jamal had been illegally deprived of his rights through that mail opening. So this case has been so corrupted by political shenanigans. It's absolutely incredible. But on the other hand, it's not incredible when we look at the systemic injustice in the justice system, when we look at cases like Leonard Peltier and cases from California all the way to New York City.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with Lynn Washington. He talks to us from the Philadelphia area, where he teaches at Temple University Journalism, specializes in teaching journalism and the law. And that is of great interest in the context of this case, because there have been many investigations that talk about the impossibility of Mumia Abu-Jamal to get a fair trial in Philadelphia and the surrounding area.
Dennis, let me just give you and your listeners a couple of statistics. As of about a year or so ago, and then when we go back over a 15 to 20 year period, over 200 death penalty cases and life sentences, over 200 first degree murder cases have been overturned by Pennsylvania state courts and federal courts for a variety of reasons. Ineffective assistance of counsel, prosecutorial misconduct, in a few instances, judicial improprieties. And incredibly, of that 214 as of earlier this year, the courts have said that there has been not a single error in the Abu Jamal case that warrants him getting a new trial. Now, statistically, that's improbable, that you could have 214 cases with a whole raft of violations that courts have recognized, but in the case in Pennsylvania that has received the most attention and scrutiny internationally, and the case that perhaps has the most glaring abuses, for the courts to say that there is not a single instance of impropriety, a major instance of impropriety, is absolutely absurd. But that's what they've said.
It was the 21st century's first act of biological terrorism. And that set investigative journalist Bob Cohen on his journey to penetrate the darkest secrets of many countries, allies and enemies alike, and all linked by their common pursuit of the ultimate bioweapon.
Indeed, sound from the new film Anthrax War by Eric Nadler and Bob Cohen. They have a companion book, Dead Silence, Fear and Terror of the Anthrax Trail. Just before airtime, we were joined by Eric Nadler, one of the producers of Anthrax War, and as I said, co-author of Dead Silence, about those attacks. He began with this thumbnail sketch of the initial attacks right after 9/11.
Well, the anthrax attacks following 9/11 events, World Trade Center, Pentagon, the downed airplanes, was basically the second punch in a 1-2 punch against our republic. I'm from New York, and I lived through the anthrax attacks, and many hard-boiled New Yorkers did that, but lived through the 9/11. But when the anthrax attacks came, we felt especially vulnerable because this poison came through the mails. Theoretically, it could have gotten anybody and ended up being fairly non-discriminatory, and whom it actually killed. Five people died, 22 were injured, a lot of postal workers, a photo editor in Florida, a grandmother in Connecticut, a Vietnamese nurse in the Bronx, and postal workers in suburban Washington. They all died. And we watched as my partner and I, Bob Cohen, watched as the 9/11 events were commemorated and much discussed from people all over the political spectrum, from the truth movement to government commission that studied and came to some controversial conclusions. But it seemed to us that the anthrax attacks were soon forgotten. There weren't any annual memorials. The FBI seemed to have a cold case going for many years, and their number one suspect, a man they never actually called a suspect, they called him a person of interest, Stephen Hatfill, was a United States Army microbiology worker in the defense program, and he was a tough guy. He fought back and eventually sued the government for leaks against him, and the Justice Department had to pay him $5.8 million just to get him to go away. And so the case seemed to be going absolutely nowhere, and we were in the editing room working on the film, in which we were basically going to say that the anthrax attacks had faded from public view and making some suggestions as to why, when last August of 2008, they suddenly announced that they had their man. Unfortunately, he was dead, but he was a U.S. Army scientist, another one, not as tough as Hatfill, apparently, because he committed suicide under federal investigation, a guy by the name of Bruce E. Ivins, and the FBI says the worst biological terrorist attack in the history of the planet was an inside job from the U.S. military, and that's where our film basically begins.
All right. Now, so Hatfield, I guess, sues. He takes him on head on and wins, settles for a good amount of money. Evans, the one who is the target, they say the culprit, the perp, did it himself, kills himself, they say, and end of story. So it's sort of like the largest FBI investigation in history with the smallest focus.
That's right. In other words, from the get-go, the FBI decided to do what they generally always do in high-profile and controversial matters, is they decided to look for a lone gunman, or in this case, a lone mailman, because anything that included another person was a conspiracy, and that opens a whole can of worms. So the lone gunman theory is very convenient for the federal authorities. One man went crazy for whatever his deluded reasons were. He put the anthrax in the envelopes, and that's that. Case closed. Of course, with Ivan's suicide, they'd never have to go into court and prove anything. And what we did is we began immediately talking to his coworkers and his former superiors at Fort Detrick in Maryland, the United States Army's major germ defense. It used to be offense until that was outlawed. Now it's defense, but people say it's hard to tell the difference these days. But he was a key figure in their biodefense plant, and his former workers and bosses say he simply lacked the equipment to make the murder weapon. And this is where we spend some time in the film. It's complicated, but it's important. the forensics of the murder weapon, the anthrax that was actually contained in the letters to Senators Daschle and Leahy, was among the most sophisticated weaponized anthrax U.S. Army scientists had ever seen. And how do you weaponize anthrax? Anthrax occurs in nature. It has a rather large clumpiness. How you make it a real killer is you mill it down to almost molecular atomic level size, 1 micron in this case, and then you put additives on it to make sure that the molecules don't bind and that it could be inhaled by a victim and get to the deepest recesses of the lung where you die from inhalational anthrax. And in fact, U.S. Army scientists, when under a controlled situation, they were able to intercept the anthrax sent to Senator Leahy, so they were able to take it into a biosafety level laboratory, and, you know, in the moon suits and wearing the gloves in a, you know, glove box situation. They try to put the anthrax on a microscope slide to examine it, but it was so dangerous, it floated off the slide. They had never seen anthrax in a natural state like this. So what the U.S. Army said is that this anthrax used in the attacks was a very weaponized, sophisticated piece of business, and whoever made it, it was clear, was in violation of current statutes, the International Bioweapons Treaty Convention, International Arms Control Law. It's a very strict law. You can, you know, you can't be making that for any reason, and somebody made it somewhere. And people told us that it was impossible for Ivins to have made it because he was a guy at Fort Detrick who worked with liquid anthrax, and to dry it into such a magical powder, he would have needed very sophisticated equipment. The FBI says he used something along the lines of a hairdryer. His former boss, Richard Spurzel, the deputy commander of Fort Detrick, says that's ridiculous.
Yeah, and you you interview him quite extensively in the film Anthrax War, and he is rather suspicious of the investigation.
Oh, yeah. He says that the powder could not have been made at Fort Detrick and that Ivins lacked the ability to make that powder. So once you get into, okay, this guy could not have made the powder, the question begins, how did he obtain it? If he did obtain it, who made it? If the United States actually made it in its biodefense complex, it's in violation of international treaties. This is going to cause a huge controversy worldwide. It's better if the FBI comes and says this was not weaponized anthrax and anyone could have made it in their basement and he did it, case closed. And that's where the debate lies. Was this weaponized anthrax, as the Army has said? Or is it run-of-the-mill anthrax, as the FBI has said? And right now there's a big National Academy of Sciences panel studying this key issue. And so the whole FBI case against Ivins might rise or fall on this National Academy of Sciences panel, which many people are watching closely. They expect to report in 6 months to a year.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.